and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and you just end up saying to yourself, has it really been 19 years? Has it really been 19 years? As on this September 11th, as one of our guests, Todd Aguilar, just reminded me, it is September 11th and 19 years since that terrible day in our history with so many consequences that still seem to ripple out. We're going to talk about that and many other things. As a matter of fact, that might be a good place to start because we're... Well, let me just frame a little bit about what we're going to do today. On July 4th, we invited the director of publishing here, Todd Aguilar, and our president, Chris Check, to come in, and we'll talk about a church and a culture in crisis. And we did a two-hour just discussion about church and culture in crisis. And now, as summer comes to a close, it seems like a good time, especially as we approach the election, I suppose, and feelings of anxiety increase. It's a good time to have another discussion. So we're Culture in Crisis 2, the sequel, I suppose, is what we'll call this hour.
Son of Culture in Crisis.
Son of Culture in Crisis.
It's not as if there's a shortage of material.
No, that's right. I guess that's a good point. Everything cleared up in the last 3 months.
Right.
Congratulations, everybody.
All the solutions that we proposed have been implemented.
Yeah. let's start with you're wearing a t-shirt, Gone But Not Forgotten, 9/11/01, FDNY. That's and NYPD too. NYPD as well is what I meant to say. Where'd you get that t-shirt?
Gosh, I don't know. My memory doesn't go back that far. We said we wouldn't forget, so I remember that it happened, and I'm not forgetting that, but I don't remember where I got the shirt.
It's in great shape. It doesn't look like you've
worn it. I wear it once a year, so I take good care of it.
Yeah. You know, the thing, it's so strange. The life of a police officer and a firefighter, and probably any other that fall into that category of first responder, we love them, we hate them, we love them again, we hate them again. It's horrible. It's like we have this weird... I think we have an authority problem. I think we might have an authority problem. But we really loved first responders, and we, in a certain sense, gave them the appreciation that should be their due every day, really, in our society. They should be respected as important people in our society on that day and then in the subsequent months. And then in subsequent years, we've come to, now we're mad at, I don't know if we're mad at them or we love them now, because we love them because of COVID, but we're mad at them because of all this racial stuff that's going on. Do you see what I'm saying? It's manic.
Schizophrenic. One of my dearest friends is a policeman in West Allis, which is a suburb just immediately west of Milwaukee, kind of a working class town. And I talk to him regularly, not as frequently as I wish, but just the accounts of what this man sees on a day-to-day basis in the course of his job, for which he doesn't, you know, receive a mountain of money, it's staggering. It's staggering the depths of horror, depravity, horror that he deals with every single day in his job. And if he weren't I wonder, because some of his colleagues on the force, they seem to be good men, but they're not devoted Christians availing themselves of the sacraments every day the way this fellow is. I don't know how you could do that job otherwise.
Yeah, I don't know.
Without the metaphysical help of the sacraments.
Right, right. One great thing about... I guess this is kind of a weird thing to say, but one of the great things about the recent coverage, though it's almost universally negative in our media about police officers, is to see some of these police chiefs and these spokes. They're just extraordinary people. They're extraordinary people. Many, many of them African-American people. I mean, I'm struck by, I remember when there was some rioting in Houston and the chief of police, I think it was the chief of police from Houston on television, just this remarkable person. And you think, we've got these great people. This is what's holding society together, is people like this. And they're somehow we've decided it's time to abuse them.
I think this speaks to what Chris said a second ago, I think, about the need for metaphysical support, for grace, for something. I think our law enforcement, like our surgeons, like our military, the horrors that they experience, as Chris is pointing out, what that must do to your soul, and we periodically show appreciation for them, and then we get a speeding ticket, and all of a sudden, they're enemies again.
Right.
I actually would like to say that I was in Minnesota a month ago, and I did get a speeding ticket, and I thanked the officer nonetheless.
Did you really?
Not for the speeding ticket, but just for doing his
job.
Oh,
good for you. Yeah, yeah, good for you. You know, there's all this talk now that they're going to get lower quality recruits because of all this
abuse. I'm sure that's true.
I wonder if it is. Because I feel like in the priesthood, after the abuse scandals, we got higher quality recruits because there were people that were, they're like, answer the bell. We need great men for this job and I'm going to do it. And I wonder if that's going to,
We're seeing a lot of early retirements right now. I have law enforcement in my family and the ranks are getting cut down right now. Everyone's getting out when they can. So if that's any indication, that seems to support the theory that we're going to get a lower grade of officer in the future.
I wonder how widespread the animosity actually is. I suspect some of it is overstated by the media. Now, we at Catholic Answers here are in East County, San Diego, which is generally regarded as, I don't know, more family-oriented than the coast.
Because you can afford a house
here. Right? Yes, human beings can afford to live here.
Normal people.
Sort of. But a couple of weeks ago, I passed Cazadores there over by the Sprouts, a little Mexican taco shop, and there were two policemen outside eating. And I said, I was walking by, I was going to the Sprouts. I said, can I get your lunch for you? And they said, oh no, somebody else already bought it for us.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yes.
That's great.
So, so I suspect, anyway, here in East County, there is an appreciation of law enforcement.
Yeah, probably in most of the country too.
I think so.
As we talk about our culture in crisis, I'm sure we'll come back again and again to the theme of the distortion that media represents. And it represents a distortion. I think even when good people engage in it, it very easily distorts what's happening. For example, I'll just give you a quick example from the news. Okay, so you go downtown and you cover some protest that's happening downtown, and there's 80 people there, okay? A TV news cameraman is told to get good shots. Well, good shots mean get up in the crowd and make the crowd look big. This is not a prejudice on the part of anybody that's trying to, but this exaggerates 80 people getting together on the steps of the, because if the cameraman goes across the street and shows, actually, this is just a small group of people on the steps of the thing and life is going on normally around them, that's not a cinematic shot. That doesn't grab the viewer. So there's a certain way in which distortion is built in, especially to the visual media. And so we, like, as you said, you put me in mind of this because you said you suspect the animosity is less than it's definitely less.
Sure.
It's people definitely have better feelings about police officers than you would guess from the media.
Well, not only is it less just because of the distortion that you point out, but there's a backlash for sure. Wake of the protests and the loud minority of cop haters, for example. And so I think that's engendering a sympathy among normal people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And maybe you might not have done that to those police officers in other circumstances. I don't know.
No,
I want to do this now.
That's well said. I was inspired to make that offer. And I encourage anybody who's listening, if you see this opportunity, go ahead and do it. Get your local cop a Slurpee if you're in line at 7-Eleven or whatever, or deliver.
I'm so glad you didn't say donut. That just is a prejudice.
I was going to say deliver some healthy snacks to the station. I was inspired to do it. It was a reaction. It was a reaction to the chaos.
Well, 19 years passed. It does feel that our society has been. Did you ever see that? Did you ever see that video of that bridge in Washington State that was built improperly so that it caught the harmonic of the wind and it started to Do you know the video I'm talking about?
Then it collapses.
And then the bridge collapses. It just starts to get a wave.
There's a car on the bridge.
Yeah. So the bridge starts to get a... The wind is blowing down this canyon where they built the bridge, and the bridge starts to...
Is it Snake River Canyon? I can't remember.
But it starts to get a wave. Well, the engineers had not designed it so that the wave would be dissipated in whatever way it's supposed to be. So the wave just gets... The gyrations get greater and greater and greater till this bridge just collapsed, just from the wind. Because it feels like our society is like that bridge since 9/11. In the last 19 years, it just feels like it's almost to the point of tearing itself apart now because of the slightest breeze knocks us over or starts us into these waves of cultural extremes that are dangerous.
It does feel sometimes like. And this is really ineffable, so it's hardly even worth mentioning, but it seems like we're in the midst of times that only the future will be able to put in perspective for. Certainly the effects of the virus and the lockdowns. If this were a novel, or if this were a screenplay treatment or something like that, or if this were a revealed scripture of some religion, there'd be all this interconnectedness that we'd come to realize later was so significant.
Right.
But we just don't know what it is yet, and it feeds paranoia, doesn't it?
That's a great, great point.
It's why you're getting requests, Cy, to do shows of Catholic Answers Live on End Times.
Mm. Yeah, right. A lot of people wanted us to talk about the End Times. And Jimmy, of course, is erratic about the whole thing. He does a good job. But you're not a dope for feeling that the approach of some, what is it? It could be the end times, but it just doesn't seem good what we're headed to. It doesn't seem like we're headed to greater stability. It seems like the bridge is getting closer and closer to a catastrophic collapse, despite the fact that it seemed strong before the wind started blowing.
And we're casting about for solutions that in the end are not going to solve the problem.
I have a fundamental premise that I want to share with you when we come back from the break, especially as we approach the election, and that is this, that part of the reason we are fragile and that slight winds can cause such huge gyrations and upsets in our culture is that we devoted ourselves probably in the months and years after the Roe versus Wade decision to a lie that is so extreme that it has distorted the personality of the country, and we're still paying for it. And not only are we still paying for it, we'll continue to pay for it until we address the lie at the heart, the deadly, murderous lie at the heart of our culture. So as we talk about, as we continue our A Crisis in Culture Continued, that's what I'll call it, A Crisis in Culture Continued, our second attempt in months to solve all the world's problems by inviting Todd Agliolaro, the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers, and Chris Check, the president of Catholic Answers, in for a conversation about what's going on and what are we to do about it. We'll do that, and I will ask them about my premise when we come back right after this.
Catholic Answers Live. We're here for you.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
I looked it up at the break. It's the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, 1940, that it collapsed. And if you feel like you're living on the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in the moments before the collapse, you have lots of company. Many people are feeling that way. You can look at it on the internet, by the way. The film is out there of this just an extraordinary thing that happened to this bridge. Okay, so we don't want to just be utterly negative, but we do want to get to the roots of the crisis, I suppose. And then we'll talk. We have lots and lots of things to talk about over the course of the next few hours, including the role of the church in all of this, the role of Pope Francis. Pope Francis got a new encyclical coming out. You probably both knew that. It's Brothers and Sisters to One Another, or I think is roughly the English name of it. That'll be out soon. We'll talk about that. And so many other things to talk about this moment of crisis, this ongoing kind of continuing moment of crisis, even peril, one might say, for our society. It's certainly peril for many of the people, old and young, the vulnerable. They actually live in peril at every moment in our society now, in many cases. We're not taking calls today. We're just having our conversation. We have had some suggestions from listeners who have sent in things that they'd like us to cover, so we'll also get to some of those. But I want to go back to my premise, especially as we approach the election, because, look, there's going to be this debate that happens, as happens every year. How should a Catholic, every 4 years, or basically whenever there's a presidential election, what are a Catholic's obligations to vote? There's going to be people implying that you're the devil if you vote Republican, you're the devil if you vote Democrat. All this, we're going to do this. We do that every 4 years. We're going to tear at each other about all this. But prescinding from that for the moment, what about this premise that I suggest? And I have to say, some would go even much further back to the kind of advent of the contraceptive pill and all of that. But certainly with Roe versus Wade and the commitment immediately after Roe versus Wade of every major media outlet in the U.S. to be supportive of it, to say that this resolves the issue, to try to move beyond it. And then, television throughout the 1970s with Norman Lear's television programs and whatnot, just constant decision almost in Hollywood and in the major media that we are going to sell Roe versus Wade to the people as a good thing, a thing that a good person would support, that corrupted the media. It corrupted print media, movies, television. It corrupted the courts. It corrupted our society in a way that we're paying the price for now, because if you commit yourself to the lie that killing a baby is not killing a baby, truth is gone. You are no longer connected to reality in a way that can keep society healthy, safe, and whole.
Cy, Pope St. John Paul II and Christi Fidelis Laici said, "The inviolability of the person, which is a reflection of the absolute inviolability of God, finds its primary and fundamental expression in the inviolability of human life. Above all, the common outcry which is justly made on behalf of human rights, for example, the right to health, to home, to work, to family, to culture, is false and illusory if the right to life, the most basic and fundamental right and the condition for all other personal rights, is not defended with the maximum determination." So, yeah, if you don't get that one right, then nothing else will make sense.
Not only will it not make sense, though, my thesis to you is that it has perverted us as a culture. It has bent us to the point where we are no longer mentally and spiritually well.
Yeah, how do you describe a culture that is inured to 60 million dead babies?
You could hold it the United States of America. Yeah. I don't know what else.
Well, you mentioned contraception, and it's certainly not an idea that originates with me, that that there's kind of a domino effect there stemming from the Griswold versus Connecticut decision in, was it 68?
You're ahead of me. I don't know.
Yeah, even at the natural level.
Yeah, well, and the legal and the cultural level. On the legal level, it established the right to privacy, and it was cited in Roe v. Wade in 73. And there's kind of a slippery slope that we started going down. Of course, we started going down before that, but the red thread through it all is unfettered sexual license. And because our sexuality is so central to what we are, and it's such a powerful, powerful force, and it's a powerful force because it's a participation in the creative act of God. So, I mean, it's theologically rooted. And it's naturally fitting that it should be so powerful as well. But once you twist that, and you sever this cooperation, the creative act of God from the source of its power, and you use it for other means, and that's what contraception allowed us to do. Then it's just a relatively short step from there to severing that creative act from to canceling out the product of that creative act when it's not wanted.
Right.
And so it's funny, yeah. you said in setting this up that we say a baby is not a baby. And of course, in the early 70s, we didn't have sonogram technology
like
we had shortly thereafter. Of course, I don't want to excuse too much the architects of Roe v. Wade and pro-abortion activists of the 60s and early 70s, but at least there was a little bit more of a plausible deniability probably about the humanity of the unborn.
Yeah, because what you can't see, you couldn't see.
You,
it. Yeah, right.
And you had enough kind of countermeasures being thrown around. You know, well, when is the quickening? What do philosophers say about this? There's been debate about this for centuries, and we're never going to settle it. So, it's above our pay grades, as Barack Obama once famously said. So as that became less and less plausible with the window into the womb that the sonogram and other technologies afforded us, well, then they had to kind of change the argument, and it became even more insidious now, where we say, in essence, yes, we're killing a baby here. But that baby is—it's kind of a justified sacrifice, on the altar of sexual license.
Right, right. But that is—that has sickened us. Like the person that can do that—that's a moral. I mean, for some people, I know that they are innocent in the sense that they're invincibly ignorant, and they're just not going to get this. I'm sure that there are many people like that, but. For most normal people, to be able to look at a 4D sonogram, like they play it, you know, on a GE commercial during the Super Bowl, everyone's seen it. It's not like maybe not everyone's seen the Super Bowl, but to look at that, to say, yes, you can kill that person, then that allows all these other kind of distortions of reality because you're committed to baloney.
It's satanic. I'm sorry.
That's a good point. It's satanic. He's the father of lies.
I think back to General Wesley Clark, who was a presidential candidate. Was it in 2000 or 2004? I'm getting old, but if you remember,
short-lived.
Yes, yeah. He wasn't much of a candidacy, but no. He was asked back when they still asked this question in debates: when does life begin? And he hemmed and he hawed, and finally the best he could say was, life begins with a mother's decision.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's the radical autonomy that we're talking about there, right. That's so satanic.
But that's my gender is my decision now.
You know,
we've come to that. And, you know, we haven't gotten to the point where you can say my race is my decision. I choose what race I am, because there are other factors and forces in play there. But the fact that you could get kicked off Twitter for saying gender and sex are the same thing. They are not two different things. You know, you're a male or you're a female. There's not a secret hidden compartment in your brain where you're actually secretly a female, though every other cell in your body is male. So you see, this is not even acceptable in polite conversation in many places. Certainly here in California, it's not.
Wesley Clark, of course, who was responsible for the taking of lives of Serbian Christians during our invasion of the Balkans. I don't even know if schizophrenia is sufficient to describe the internal contradictions that someone has to manage in his intellect or in his imagination in talking about abortion. We started the hour recalling the 19th anniversary of the Trade Towers. The Czechs were in New York a couple of summers ago, and I went to the monument. I don't know if either of you have been
there.
I've
never been. No.
It's quite moving, and you know these deep holes in the ground and the water cascading. But the most compelling thing when you walk around and read the list of names is not infrequently or periodically, not too infrequently, you'll come across the name of a woman, you know, and her unborn child. So here there is an acknowledgement. And by the way, surely within a mile radius of the Trade Tower Monument, there's an abortuary where the lives of unborn children are being taken. So, which is it?
Yeah.
And while we were talking about Supreme Court cases, which one really kind of got us going and how they interconnect, in the 80s was Supreme Court versus Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Yeah.
And it was that decision that contained the infamous line from Anthony Kennedy, at the heart of human liberty. Maybe we'll pick this up after.
Yeah, the sweet mystery of life passage.
That's
it's
right.
Now called. Yeah, right. We have to come back to that because it's such an important, it's a seminal line in American and world history, I think. And of course, it's elided in the media, but we'll come back to that. But we'll also talk about our obligations as voters, given what we're saying about the distortions of our culture. We'll do that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, our culture's in crisis. On July 4th of this year, we invited Director of Publishing here at Catholic Answers, Todd Agliolaro, and our President of Catholic Answers, Chris Check, to come in for a conversation about our culture being in crisis. We thought July 4th was a good day to do it. And now, as summer comes to an end, we've passed Labor Day, and we're into the crazy time for the presidential election here in the United States. It'll be a time of, you know, profound and calm and well-reasoned moral conversation about the direction of our country. Is that what you guys are expecting? Or it will be unsourced articles in magazines about what everybody's been doing at home. It'll be one of those two things. You figure it out. But it's as we do that. We thought it'd be a great time, and maybe we'll continue to do this because we just really like talking with Todd and Chris about this continuing crisis that we are in, that has been certainly stirred up or given energy by the COVID crisis this year, by the riots and things of this year, by the shootings and killing, and certainly that horrific killing of George Floyd on the ground that was videotaped. All these things have added to the sense of crisis this year.
Si, I know you're going to go to a deeper point too, but you. In your introduction to this segment here, make a very important point that I encourage our listeners to think about. And you're talking about the quality of the discourse, if we can use that expression, or the kind of discourse leading up to the presidential election. That in itself, that very much is a barometer of the advanced state of decay in which our country's in. And I mean, I think, my friends, it's very important to be very explicit about this, because we don't like to say that America is an advanced state of decay. But it is. It is. If you're killing, if you've killed 60 million babies or whatever the figure is, and if you can't even say what a human person is, or that human person has a right to life, then you're in an advanced state of decay. But that decay is reflected in the quality of the discourse. So, when it has devolved, if that's the word, into nasty exchanges on Twitter where, oh my goodness, I think I brought this up once before on the show. I don't know. This performing, performer, Cardi B, insulting the First Lady of the United States on her Twitter account. Really, why? To draw attention to herself and attention to her song, her vulgar song. This is the level of the discourse in our country right now. Yeah. It's not the, it's, people aren't reading.
No, that's right. It's not the Lincoln Douglas debates, you know?
It's not the Constitutional Convention. It's not the Kennedy Nixon debate.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's not.
I don't know. I can't disagree. Social media has made everybody awful, and we live in a egotistical existence right now. But as with the cultural crisis in general, we could probably comfort ourselves with a little bit of research that this is probably something that's been a constant in human history. I know I've just skimmed and picked through Roman political debates, for example. And they said nasty things to each other then too.
I think they used complete sentences.
Well, all right. Yeah. So we're subliterate as well.
To your point, Todd, I think about the pornographic engravings, the vulgar pornographic engravings that were made and distributed around the time of the revolution in France, for example, talking about the bad behavior of the queen and things of this nature. Mm-hmm. So it's true. I think we get it.
Vulgar engravings made during the Reformation age era about priests and bishops. Some of them are. You know. So I think that there's a low base reality to fallen human nature that repeats itself periodically.
It's just spread so instantaneously.
Well, yes,
but you were getting to before we went to the break, we were talking about a kind of sickness has come upon our culture because of the. Basically, the lying about what is a human being and which human beings are worth, and not just the lying, but also the killing. I don't, they're both bad. So if you turn yourselves into liars and killers, you reduce your chances of getting lots of things right because you're committed to courses of action that are inhuman. And you were pointing to this line from the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision, mm-hmm. which really is a horrible moment in human history.
Well, yeah, and it shows that the lying that you talk about is self-deception as much as it is willful deception of others. The line, which I don't have memorized, but it begins with, "At the heart of human liberty," Anthony Kennedy wrote, "lies, in essence, the power to determine for ourselves who is alive and who isn't, and what life is, and these mysteries." You called it the sweet mystery of life passage.
It's
a funny way of putting it. And I refer to it as a kind of radical view of human autonomy that is demonic, and it shows a kind of red thread from this radical autonomy we exercised over sex and its meaning by separating it from the creative partnership with God, and then the product of that, which is a human life, and then through that now we've seen to what our sex is. We haven't gotten a race yet, as you point out, but I don't know. That might be the next frontier. We'll see.
Right. And things that it's just that it, I guess the sense is that things that are real and solid are no longer treated as real and solid. They're treated as ephemeral, so that we can do our will. so that we in order. And so when you become willful, you are in a very sick state. You're in a very sick state. Well, I guess that's...
Well, that's the story of every sin we commit, isn't it? I mean, it's just writ large.
Yeah.
Well, sins especially related to sex, we know from St. Thomas, he says unchastity's firstborn daughter is blindness of the spirit. So once someone descends into these kinds of sins, then he does not think clearly. And, yeah. he's able to manage all of these internal contradictions. They don't really matter to him. The devil, for example, does not want the terms of this conversation to be actually defined. It's better for him if they are not. We could have a conversation with the pro-abort side if we could agree, okay, it is a human life.
Yeah.
So let's agree with that now.
But then you can't have that conversation, as Trent Horn proves, you know, every time he comes on. You can't have, because there will be a constantly shifting ground under you if you try to. And that is the key to a lie, is you just shift the terms whenever it starts to get pinned down. One of the strategies that Trent always points out is this tadpoling, where you just move from one thing to another. You say, well, this is killing a human being. You say, well, you hate women, you know, and then you just jump around to all these irrelevant things.
You know, they tried to come to terms with that. I don't know if you recall the feminist author and consultant Naomi Wolf.
Right.
Does that name ring a bell?
Oh, yeah.
She was the architect behind the so-called alpha male persona that Al Gore adopted in the 2000 election. So she was a highly placed Democratic political operative.
It's a brilliant strategy, political strategy.
Though
it worked. Well,
it's like Michael Dukakis in the tank. It's a, yeah, there's some things just don't do that.
Like I say, sometimes only history can teach us. But yeah. She, and I give her credit for this, for her intellectual honesty, perhaps 20 years ago, wrote an article or a series of articles in which she called upon her fellow pro-choice left-leaning folk to admit, yes, we're killing a human being here. And she drew upon, I believe, her Jewish heritage in what she wrote. And she said, we need to come to terms with that. We need to figure out a way to atone for it.
Right.
And we need to say it was a necessary killing and it's a tragedy. And only then can we cope with what is manifest, that you're killing an innocent, weak person that you should be nurturing and loving. So having done that, how do we square the circle? Well, that did not carry the day, clearly. And she subsequently lost a lot of her influence and is not considered a leading light in that, you know, that area anymore.
Yeah.
And you never see that talked about. Now you see demonstrations where they wear t-shirts saying, ask me about my abortion.
Yeah.
And so really, you can't be surprised that effort failed, though it had a certain nobility to it, because it just can't hold.
No, right. There's a point at which people will go, well, maybe you should just not kill people.
Mm.
You know, like it will occur to people if you admit that these are people, it will occur to people to go, well, maybe don't, you know, maybe don't kill that person.
Well, it's the only way to have the conversation. I could have a conversation with Naomi Wolf.
Yeah, right. You can't have a conversation with people who are avoiding the conversation. I mean, that's just not going to happen. And you avoid the conversation because the basic facts do not point to something so monstrous that you cannot admit it.
And as Trent points out quite rightly, so often when you're trying to have that conversation and failing, you're trying to have that conversation with someone who's deeply wounded, perhaps post-abortive, whether as a man or a woman, and has an immense amount of baggage and guilt that intrude upon the attempts at a conversation.
You know, I have to say, sometimes it also is the case that you're having a conversation with a person of just an unbelievable towering ego. Like there's a real arrogance to this. And I don't want to dismiss that there's deep, deep wounds.
Mm.
But there's also another side to this story of people who are willing to just be viciously arrogant.
Si, you say something very important here, and our friend Father Hugh Barber says this also. There are people who, in their current state, are ineducable. That you can't, you're not going to make any ground with them. And it's something important for our listeners to know, because they may bang their heads against the wall.
They're ineducable because of the state of their soul?
the state of their soul or their unwillingness to listen. Typically, it's a passionate or an emotional thing. Mm-hmm. I think in the main. I mean, I don't think this isn't really a very complex matter. What's a human person and what isn't?
No, you're right. Yeah. But there's a huge emotional investment.
For sure.
But sometimes it's an emotional investment that involves this weird quality of I'm right and you're wrong and you're evil. And this has a kind of spiritual arrogance to it.
We know when Trent does his show that we will get callers who want to justify the action that they have taken in their lives.
Right. Without question. Yeah. Or someone close to them took. I mean, right. Horrible things. But even people, like, we've actually had a conversation with someone on the air one time whose siblings were aborted. And wanted to defend his mother.
I remember that.
You know,
call.
That, yep. You know, and so you feel like, mm-hmm. that's such a complex psychological wound. You don't almost like, my mother killed my brothers and sisters, but let me live. And that you almost don't know how do you even work through that? That's just, there's so many layers to that, including the parental relationship, which is complex enough, you know? So you go, okay, so the person wants to defend his mother for killing his brothers and sisters because he doesn't want to say that his mother's a bad person. You just have to let that
You know
where
you really see the arrogance, and you brought that up a couple times, Si, is to me more in the debates, which we don't have so much anymore, over embryonic stem cell research.
Oh, yes.
So science, of course, is a wonderful thing, and there are wonderful scientists who make the world better. But it's also prone to arrogance, especially the science of tinkering with human life and genetics and that sort of thing. You can really get a God complex, and the perhaps the summit of the mountain for those with that complex is turning death into life, which is the sole province of God. But that's kind of what you're trying to do when you're killing embryos in order to give life to other people.
Yeah,
it's fundamental. It's biblical almost.
I've
been recommending to people in this time the third in what is called the C.S. Lewis's science fiction trilogy or space trilogy. That Hideous Strength, I think it's called. The first two are quite good too. The third one is the best. But the NICE, and now I've forgotten exactly what it stands for, where the bizarre experiments are going on in the basement, and it turns out to be, you know, satanic worship.
Yeah.
And these things are they are inextricably intertwined.
When we come back, we have to tell everybody how to vote. We'll do that. No, we're not really going to tell you how to vote, but we are going to talk about our role in breaking Please. Through this culture of...
Well, we can tell people how to vote. We can tell people...
Yeah. You go to the voting place.
Yeah, how to do it. How to
give your name.
Actually, how to think about voting. We can tell people how to think about voting.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll do that when we come back as we discuss a culture in crisis for a second time this summer with Todd Aguilaro and Chris Check.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Looking for a 2020 view on how Catholics are voting in the upcoming election? EWTN News and Real Clear Opinion Research are partnering to bring you clear and concise data on where the nation stands on issues, candidates, policies, and more by surveying Americans, including Catholics like you. And it's available now at EWTNnews.com/poll.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live as we discuss with our president, Chris Check, and the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers, Todd Aguilaro, our culture in crisis. You may remember we did this on July 4th, and we thought we'd take it up again and may do so again. Until we get this thing straightened out, we'll probably just keep doing this.
I think it'll take one more sigh, and then we'll have
one more, and then we've got the culture fixed. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Voting, it just... I don't know. You can just be certain that many intemperate things are going to be said, and sometimes that makes you not want to say anything at all. But you can't not say anything at all. And voting is a very blunt instrument. It's this or this. You know, you just get. It's like almost a. It's almost at a caveman level. There's no subtlety involved. You get to pick this guy or this guy. You get to say yes or no on this.
Why are you running down the cavemen now, Cy?
I apologize. That's, Chesterton would really would not like that. Chesterton's essay on cavemen is one of the greatest ever. But the caveman was an artist. That's what Chesterton said. So I apologize to cavemen. I didn't mean to evince an anti-caveman.
We can send you for counseling.
Thank you. I'm not an anti-cavist, but say something about voting. Say something intelligent about voting. One of you, because
voting is a moral act. It is an act that falls within the moral sphere. Actually, all actions do. Right.
All human acts.
Yeah, all human acts. Right. So you can do evil by your vote or do good. That's important to know. It's not.
But you can't do an absolute good and you can't do an absolute evil either. I mean, it's very unlikely. Unless you vote for Satan himself, it's unlikely that you would do an absolute evil. So go ahead.
You can cooperate with evil by your vote and have it not be a sin. But so it's possible to cooperate with evil and have it not be a sin, but those occasions are rare, I think.
No.
They're not
because
rare.
I have to say, I think that that's not exactly correct. Every time you vote, unless the candidate is perfect and their platform is perfect, you will have some material cooperation with evil.
Okay, very well.
So it's not rare. It's universal. That you look at every single time. So, like, every time you go to the grocery store, some company there is treating their workers unjustly, and you are materially cooperating with that. That's
right.
Part of life.
Okay.
But you really don't want to materially cooperate with grave evil or in any way. You know, some of this might be trivial, or relatively trivial.
If you intend a desire or approve of abortion by your vote, objectively, that is a mortal sin.
Well, if
do you want me to repeat that?
yes, please. I don't want to diminish that. Yes, go ahead, because that is important.
If you intend, desire, or approve of abortion by your vote objectively, that's a mortal sin with, you know, all the usual conditions, et cetera, about mortal sin.
Because that's formal cooperation.
Yeah, that's formal cooperation. But then there comes the question of material cooperation and how proximate or remote you are. But it's possible to cooperate with evil, even remote material cooperation, and have it still be a sin if you do not have a sufficiently proportionate reason.
Yes, okay.
I think it's important, and this kind of throws a little bit of a cloud into the clarity that we're trying to bring here, but to bear in mind that we vote for a candidate, not so much policies, because campaign promises being what they are, the checks and balances of our democracy being what they are, it's not direct democracy most of the time. Now, if you have a proposition, so we have a lot of direct democracy here in California, relatively speaking, we have a lot of propositions. So if there were a proposition to put a restriction on abortion or even to outlaw it altogether, then
you have a moral obligation to vote for it.
Well, at least not to vote against it. Would you be sinning by omission if you didn't vote for it? I'm not sure. But you know, there's such a disconnect often, between what a candidate says and what he can actually what he will then do, and between what he actually has the power to do, especially when it comes to abortion, because the regime is so entrenched politically. So we're nibbling around the margins, usually on the state level.
I think I may have a little disagreement with you, Todd.
Finally, it's almost an hour.
Well, yes, the regime is entrenched. However, there is in recent years at the judicial level a string of, and I don't even necessarily mean to the high court, but there have been a not inconsiderable number of appointments where potentially the at least the restrictions on the killing of the unborn might be increased. In fact, I think they have been in some states.
Yes. So the point about judges is well taken.
I think that is in this debate one of the central questions.
Yeah. Of course, even then we see manifest disconnects between what we think a politician will do when it comes to judicial appointments and what actually happens, or what the judges then in turn do. So you kind of play the percentages, I guess.
I want to. Can I ask?
It is so many layers. Like, it seems like the pro-life voter, and I believe myself to be a pro-life voter. This is primary in my mind when I go to vote. But you're thinking, what you would like is a society where states regulate abortion as in criminal terms, okay? We want states to protect unborn children.
Yes.
In order to do that, you need to have different interpretations in the federal courts of what the Constitution says about abortion, which is nothing. But so that means you need to build up a Supreme Court that will at some point overturn Roe versus Wade. That means you have to elect. So do you see what I'm saying? You're trying to get all the dominoes to fall.
Some would go even farther and say you need a Human Life Amendment, and that nothing short of that,
if that may be
is going to ultimately withstand the winds of change.
Well, right. It's very different from direct democracy, where you just say, and I'm saying this completely as a pro-life voter, there's a great deal of strategy involved.
Mm-hmm. I think I hear what both of you are saying, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with you. Particularly when it comes to that event in the voting booth, if I'm understanding you, Cy and Todd, correctly, you're suggesting that now the voter has to sort of anticipate not so much what the candidate says he will or won't do, but what is likely to happen. I don't even know how a voter's supposed to get his imagination around that. I mean, we have it stated by political candidates in the forthcoming election. I don't just mean the presidential election either, who support either by their party platform or by things that they've said directly, the killing of the unborn. That isn't a nuanced thing for me, and I don't really have to guess what might happen if I were to cast my vote.
That's
for
a
that.
Good point. I mean, like in our recent governor.
Am I right? I don't have to guess what might happen if I vote for one of those candidates.
Well, we have experienced a lot of disappointment in that regard.
Right. But how about this? Yeah. If I vote for someone who belongs to a party whose platform, the platform of which supports the killing of the unborn, or if I vote for someone who has stated clearly that they support the killing of the unborn, it isn't a lot of mental gymnastics on my part to figure out where that person is going in terms of policy.
Yeah,
I'd say two things.
That's
one, yes. And this is in support of what Chris just said. The first point, you can get to a very concrete level. So one example would be, is a presidential candidate going to issue executive orders? Does he say he's going to issue executive orders that will undo the Mexico City policy, for example?
Oh, that's a good point.
Or get some of the low-hanging fruit to fund abortion, to fund pro-abortion organizations, to fund overseas abortions. We're not anywhere near the sphere of do we outlaw it or do we keep it legal, but just around the periphery. And there, a president or a governor or some other executive may have power, that and we can anticipate a pretty direct connection. But my second point I would say is as to the mental gymnastics, or the phrase that Chris just used. We have some music.
You've got
playing
60
now.
Seconds.
You got
to tee it off.
There's a similar argument that we make with regard to the death penalty. And can we vote for a candidate who's nominally pro-capital punishment? And one argument that's made in support of that is to say, look, there's no legislation in front of us right now to outlaw the death penalty. A. B. Executions are exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
And many states do not even have them. So its viability as kind of a live political issue is relatively limited.
We have to take a break. We'll come back. I do think we all agree vote pro-life. None of us is
sure
in any way undermining that thought. Say yes.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. We'll be right back.
I was the most explicit.
Yeah, no, I just want to make sure that I don't close the hour without explicitly saying vote pro-life, vote pro-life, vote pro-life. Be right back.